Welcome to Energy Thinks, a podcast about how the oil and gas industry will lead into the energy future. I'm Tisha Schuler, your host and the CEO of Adamantine Energy. This year, 2024, I'm focusing on the two essential ingredients for energy leadership today, and you will hear about both of them in the podcast. The first is that company leaders need to have a vision for the energy future that engages and compels our often skeptical stakeholders. And the second thing we have to have is an ability to execute on the nuts and bolts of that vision, providing proof points to these skeptical stakeholders that we are all in. So today's conversation follows that perfectly. And I welcome Diane Berman, who's commissioner on the New York State Public Service Commission. So that commission regulates electric, gas, steam, water, and telecom in the state of New York. She's also a member of NARUC, which is the National Association of Regulatory Utility Commissioners. And she serves on committees related to critical infrastructure, natural gas, and pipeline safety. Diane has a long history with the commission, which she talks about in our conversation today. And she's also served in other roles in the judicial system of New York, including assistant attorney general, counsel to Senate Republicans, and special counsel to the commission. Diane also serves as the vice chair of PHMSA, which many of you know as the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, Gas Pipeline Advisory Committee to the U.S. Department of Transportation. You can learn more about Diane's biography in our show notes. There's so much to love and learn from in this conversation. I am delighted to share with you my conversation with Diane Berman. Diane Berman, welcome. Thank you so much for joining me on the Energy Thinks podcast.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So I first want to thank you for your service. You have a tough job on New York's Public Service Commission, and such commissions are now the front lines of how people are playing out their visions of the energy future. I'm wondering if you could talk to our audience a little bit about what are your responsibilities and how do you manage this world of stakeholders that see the energy future so differently?
Oh, thank you for the question. So I have actually been a public servant for nearly 28 years, and five of them were as a staffer to the commission years ago, and now I'm in my 11th year as a commissioner. So nearly half of my public service career has been dedicated to being a part of the Public Service Commission and energy issues. So I really kind of look at it as the challenge and the goal of me as a state energy regulator is to try to balance our policies with reliability, environmental sustainability, and the cost of energy supply to meet the needs of consumers and to be supportive of the growth of our state's economy. And we have many challenges with a Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act. Like many states, a climate act that really sets some aggressive goals. And we are focused on achieving greenhouse gas emission reductions for the electric sector. At least 70% of the New York's electricity must come from renewable energy sources, such as wind and solar, by 2030. And the state's power system must be 100% carbon-free by 2040. So the commission has a role in doing this, and we're legally required to ensure safe and adequate service at just and reasonable rates. And for me, the mission I take very seriously is that we really do have to understand the nature of the vulnerabilities and the overall risks faced in our energy future. And we, as we move forward with our decarbonization goals and our grid infrastructure improvements, we have to recognize that we as commissioners must ensure we do not lose sight of reliability and resiliency of the grid, and we do so with costs in mind. And we have to keep in mind that it is not a one-size-fits-all, and what can derail us is if we are not mindful of what the stakeholders, which include very much so the public, think about this and what are their concerns, and looking at ensuring reliability and affordability are not discounted.
The picture you're painting is really where this idea of aspiration and a lot of aspiration around the energy future, well, it can be untethered from some of the real difficult challenges of what you're articulating, which is how do you make sure you get energy to people in a way that's reliable and affordable and decarbonizing and meeting all of these goals. So you're just sitting at this interface of aspiration and reality. And I'm wondering, can you talk a little bit about what you see in there for the state of New York? What do you see in that middle space that I think the challenges are pretty obvious, although not to everyone? What also are the opportunities to find a path forward, to drive progress? How do you think about the range of opportunities and challenges for New York in this space?
I do think that it is about a combination of the challenges and the opportunities. It's about really understanding that we've articulated a vision of the energy future through our Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act. And this vision of the future includes reductions in greenhouse gas emissions and with accompanying increases in renewable energy. And it's necessary for us to understand where we were, where we are, and where we're going, and to understand that we have to be accountable to, as the commission, accountable to the ratepayers. It's no small thing that we are stewards for the ratepayers, and we have to take that responsibility very seriously. And there are tremendous challenges with trying to reduce greenhouse gas emissions while maintaining affordability for customers, protecting disadvantaged communities, and looking at ways to improve the lives of the people that live in New York and improve the environment for all New Yorkers and advance clean energy technologies that will hopefully help in this. We have to be mindful of the fact that the majority of our infrastructure, electric system in New York, is made up of diverse assets, including plants fueled by natural gas, oil, and nuclear fuel, as well as wind, solar, and hydropower assets. And our diversity has historically provided security, especially during periods of high load. And we have to recognize that our state's electric generators run on natural gas. They take service mainly on an interruptible basis, and that keeps costs low in the summer when heating demand is low, but it does lead to tight supply in the winter. And so dual fuel capacity has helped us with this issue. As we move forward, we have to recognize that our New York State greenhouse gas emissions have substantially over the years decreased. And by achieving the CLCPA, as we call our Climate Act greenhouse gas goals, it's only going to make things more sticky, and more challenging as we go forward. Currently, renewables comprise a small or modest portion of New York State's electricity resources. So meeting our targets are going to require all of us to sort of lean in and figure out what that looks like. Our reliance on natural gas for winter electric generation has only grown, and it has grown to the point that it has outpaced available pipeline capacity that was built mainly for meeting heating needs. We have a strong need for fuel diversity as we focus on decarbonization. I strongly believe that we need multiple resources to play a role in our state's overall energy future as we seek to lower emissions. And for me, at our core, the energy system must be reliable and resilient, and energy regulation must smartly evolve to meet the growing demands of our society. And we have to recognize that when renewables by itself are not enough to balance supply and demand, we need something like natural gas that's going to help ensure energy is reliably given. Or going forward, decarbonization is actually going to increase power demand. It's going to increase the need for technologies to integrate renewables. It's going to need for us to look at what significant grid alterations need to be taken care of. And we also have to look at the fact that as the percentage of renewable resources increases, the way we plan and operate the system must evolve. We have to look at designing it for the current mix on our generation resources to be responsibly transitioning. My core focus is also with the intermittency of renewables and the electrification of the economy, substantial clean energy and dispatchable resources, some with yet to be developed technology, over and above the capacity of all existing fossil resources that will need to be replaced. We're going to have to really think outside of the box and make sure that we are maintaining reliability. And I do believe that gas has a role to play in this.
Dan, I think our listeners, if they didn't know who you were, they're now super clear on why I wanted to have you on the podcast, because it's easy to deal in these topics and sound bites. It's easy to deal in like, well, it's not our problem. Like, the legislature told us we had to do it. What I see in other states where Adam and Teen works with our clients is there's this, no one owns the problem. Someone, maybe a legislature, maybe an executive order, like, passed down a mandate. And then whether it's other legislators or agencies, you find a lot of people going like, well, that's what they told us to do. And well, we'll just have to cross our fingers and hope for the best. And when I hear you talk about stickiness, when I hear you talk about leaning in, when I hear you talking about thinking outside the box, these hard conversations, the burden of governance, the burden of doing this well with our eyes wide open is something that I see you doing. And I really, really value that and appreciate that. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about when and how does one push back, or when and how are the confluence of aspiration and reality going to, like, we're going to have to say, well, we're not going to meet that because we can't do it affordably and reliably. What's your thought about how we lean in to the stickiness in a way that allows us, without soundbites, without more political polarization nonsense, we say, okay, let's agree that there's trade-offs to be made here. How do you think about that stickiness?
So I think it's really important that folks feel that we are honest brokers. And what that means is that we have to acknowledge sort of the elephants in the room. We have to acknowledge what it's going to take to achieve our decarbonization goals. And we have to look at really asking the questions of things like, how are we planning on doing this effectively for the short term and the long term? How do we define success? And how are we trying to accomplish it? And are there other ways of doing it? Many times, legislation is passed, which is well-meaning, but when it goes to be implemented, in this case by the regulator, we see sort of the challenges with that. And for us, at least I see it, is that we have a role to not just be a check the box. Legislation says we must do this, so therefore we're going to do it. Not our fault if things go awry. I really feel it's important for us to look at how can we responsibly address the legislation in a way that is making sure we're meeting our legal obligations, but doing it in a way that is fundamentally helping the feasibility of the energy transition. We have to look at what those fundamental risks are. With decarbonization, we have risks that we have to look at in risk to the operators for stranded assets. We have to look at the risk of energy supply instability as a result of ramping down oil and gas production without being the requisite increase in renewables being there to ensure reliability. We have to look at the risk of continued operations of emission initiatives. And rather than looking at it as decommissioning or decarbonization, we have to look at what does it mean with our assets and how can we pair it with our renewables? We have to look at the fact that there's a risk that the rapid transition away is going to result in chaotic instability. And we have to, at the core, all understand that it is not about saying, well, it's not our fault, it's this person's fault, it's that entity's fault. We all play a role, a critical role, in managing these risks and really being honest brokers in helping to set the stage on what we need to do. And that may mean we have to look at redefining what success looks like, because if we are going to not share some of the challenges like reliability and affordability, and we lose sight of that, we're going to go backwards because people are not going to trust us in what we're trying to do. And so for me, I think it's a positive development that more New Yorkers than ever are paying attention to our energy needs. But with this focus on the energy transition, we have to really make sure that we are giving them the tools that they need to fully understand what we're doing. And also, we have to be aware that we have responsibility to make sure that we are doing it to improve our economy, improve the energy market, improve the energy for residential and business customers.
I really like the nuance and the complexity you embrace in this work, because that's how we're going to meet these dual challenges of decarbonizing and meet energy needs. Nowhere is this more politically fraught at the moment, I think, than in the conversation around natural gas, because it gets oversimplified as this thing we can move away from when we really don't have a viable alternative in places like New York to keep the lights on. And you mentioned that you see a role for natural gas in the future. Can you talk a little bit about how you think of natural gas in the context of decarbonizing? Is it an either or is natural gas part of the moving a system to lower carbon emissions?
So I totally think that it's not an either or. I think it's a pairing. I think there's a huge role for natural gas in our state's climate goals. I think there's a huge role. I mean, I think that we have to recognize that natural gas will be here for a long time and can actually be a positive partner in helping us achieve our reductions in greenhouse gas emissions and in helping us move to a more responsible next steps and decarbonization. And so for me, when I look at it from a aggressive goals and then how do we implement, to me, it's about looking at what can gas do. Right now, gas has always been a very important part of our energy assets. And so it's really about helping to find ways to prove the value of natural gas in reducing greenhouse gas emissions. It has to have rigorous accountability around that. We also have to look at ways to work together to develop fuels like renewable natural gas or hydrogen to make their product less carbon intensive. And we can work together with folks on that. And we have to look at other things that have been helpful, like reducing pressure on customers' bills with energy efficiency programs and looking at ways that we can also continue to ensure that the grid is as resilient as it needs to be and the infrastructure is there so that we are not operating on a shoestring and helping to cause problems with our system because we are not taking care of the infrastructure that we have.
So the picture you paint is really, I think, really jives with one that we think about at Adamantine about using the resources we have in increasingly efficient and decarbonizing ways. And so I like the picture of blending with lower carbon options, replacing with lower carbon options, but continuing this journey that includes natural gas. Now, one thing that we have found in our work with a public that is the climate forward, that's climate hawkish, there's a deficit of trust with the natural gas industry. And so I'm wondering from your seat, this very central seat you have at the table, do you have advice for our audience, which is leaders of oil and gas companies, on things they can be doing to build trust with the public that they are committed to reducing their environmental footprint and committed to reducing their carbon intensity, and that they have earned a seat in the energy present and in the energy future?
Yeah, I think it's really important. I mean, I think that people need to feel that leaders, in this case, in the natural gas space, are really stepping up and helping to not just say the talking points or the good press statement that we're all in with you, but really showing how they are doing that, showing what they're looking at to advance technologies that can help, like low carbon fuels with renewable natural gas or hydrogen, looking at what they're doing to showcase in a real way the continued reductions of greenhouse gas emissions, looking at ways such as certified natural gas, looking at other opportunities that they can to show the coordination between what they're trying to do and how it's going to move forward in a way that is really going to be helpful. I believe strongly that too often it comes down to people not communicating with each other and communicating in a way that can't just be like me with legislation. I can't just check the box in my regulatory role. I have to live and breathe it. And I feel like for natural gas company leaders, they also have to continue to live and breathe and build trust in their ability to lead into the energy future. And they can only do that if they're really taking the pulse of what their customers want and also how they are really helping with the workforce in making sure that they're being accountable in all of that.
So many great points there. And I think very, very in line with the way that we're thinking about this work, which is that companies need to be part of these broader, stickier conversations. Not, you know, we just play this, like we just answer the call when you want gas, we answer the call. But no, like we're a part of understanding the range of stakeholder perspectives and also providing novel solutions, thinking outside the box, being a thought partner and a civic leader in answering the call to these questions. And I love the way you're thinking about it, because it's not just vision, it's proof points. It's like companies have to demonstrate that they mean it, that they're in the trenches getting this work done. And I couldn't agree more. I want to pivot to one thing you mentioned earlier that is so important and is really difficult to talk about in a coherent way. And that's the affordability of energy. So because I work with energy companies, if companies want to talk about energy affordability, it sounds like a pat talking point, right? It sounds like, oh, you're just defending your profit margin. But really, when we're talking about transforming the energy system, we're talking about this massive range of energy consumers, from low-income households to rural households, small businesses, big industrial customers. Like, there's kind of nothing more fundamental to your economic well-being than having affordable and reliable energy. And I'm wondering, how are you thinking about this? And how do you elevate the conversation about affordability without getting dismissed as just like a political talking point?
Yeah, so I think it's really important. Energy affordability has become the buzzword everywhere because it is so important, right? Because we recognize that the feasibility of the energy transition can be derailed if it isn't affordable, and also understanding that there's going to be a need to address who pays for what and how are we doing it in a way that is feasible for folks. So I look at it as, first, you cannot just say we want energy affordability. You have to understand what energy affordability is to everyone. It is a different thing for different people. And so for me, having to recognize that energy is personal. Every person has a need for energy in some way unique to them. And the disruption in that access to energy can be really detrimental. If the lights go out during a storm for me, I may be able to afford to drive somewhere to stay at a hotel while the power comes back on. Someone else may not have that luxury. And really having to understand the folks that are primarily affected by this and helping to do it in a way that is addressing what they perceive as their affordability issue, what they see as the need for us to really take into account what it means for them to not have proper access to affordable energy. And I do think that it takes all of us leaning in, and it takes all of us really considering not what we see as the answers, but what really is helpful to the folks who are going to need us to be accountable on that issue.
Diane, what you're talking about, and I've never thought about it like this, so I'm excited to spend more time pondering this, is not just leading into the technical complexity of the energy transition, but leaning into the emotional complexity of the energy transition. A lot of the reason perhaps we all talk past each other with these polarized sort of visions of the future is we're not, I love this idea that energy is personal. And what I heard in that is energy is emotional. You know, it's tied to your sense of security and well-being, ability to provide. And that's just a wholly different conversation with a group of stakeholders than my talking points and your talking points. Do you think I have that right? And do you find that this is an emotionally charged space that requires a different kind of intelligence and engagement?
Yeah, I do. I'll give you my own sort of personal perspective. And I really bring this to my work as a regulator. August 2003, the blackout of Northeast in 2003, I was a young mother, two children. I had just gone back to work after the birth of my second child. And the blackout happened. And it was very scary for me as a young mother to go get one child from school, another child from the daycare, and then make my way back to my home with the traffic lights out and not knowing what was happening, not being able to access my cell phone to call my husband. And when I got to my house, which is really where I felt like, okay, now I'm safe, I'm at my house. When I walked into my house, I had no power. And what that meant for me was that my freezer full of breast milk was completely wiped out. And it was, for me, realizing that the energy, resiliency, and reliability that I counted on was not there for me in something that was very personal to me in this freezer full of frozen breast milk. And they say you're not supposed to cry over spilled milk. I definitely cried. But I kind of take that in that I understand that feeling of hopelessness and feeling like something failed me with the power system. And so I have to really put myself in the shoes of other people in their own experiences, some way worse than mine, when the power is not there. And that means we have an obligation in looking at how can we evolve in our roles as regulators to make sure that we don't lose sight of the importance of the light staying on. And if the lights go out, they come back on as soon as possible.
Diane, thank you for sharing that. Such a great illustration of how unique. This is going to infiltrate my work. So how unique each of our relationship is and how important it is if we want to serve as civic leaders in this time to make space for a huge array of personal relationships with energy. Such a novel, great takeaway. So thank you for that. In that spirit, in your work, are there more stakeholders that you wished were engaged in this conversation around energy transition that it just hasn't hit their radar yet, even though their lives will ultimately be impacted by the decisions that you're making? Who do you wish was more attuned to what's happening, who maybe isn't?
So it's a great question. Interestingly, we are on our fifth year, celebrating the fifth year anniversary soon of our Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act. And it is not lost on me that despite sort of my living and breathing this law since 2019, that the majority of stakeholders in New York are not really actively engaged in what is happening with the energy transition, because many of them have yet to be impacted. So it doesn't have meaning necessarily that much meaning for them. What that means, though, for me, is that I have an obligation not to expect them to be educated and then come share their thoughts with me and be engaged. I have a responsibility to make sure that I understand the impact that is going to happen, not just in the short term, but in the long term and in the future for the very people that may not yet be engaged, and try to figure out how to engage them to get the information that we all need to make informed policy decisions that can be long-lasting in a positive way. And that, for me, is really important because we have to have more people participating also from the perspective of, again, looking at how can we help solve the problem? How can we look at what it means for them and some of the unintended consequences to what we're doing that negatively impacts them or may perhaps positively impact them? And really have this sort of participation by all folks that can give their best thoughts to us and get also the technical experts to be able to help us in doing this in a way that I think can really bring us more together than separate from each other.
Diane, it's such an important point you just made. It kind of harkens back to that earlier question I had, which is a lot of leaders we're seeing in agencies are kind of going, well, these are the stakeholders I'm hearing from, and they tend to have the off fossil fuels today, energy transition immediately. And you're saying you're charged with representing the stakeholder who will be impacted but doesn't know it yet. One, that is, I mean, it's just so important. But two, like you have to hold so much in your mind and no one is yelling on their behalf, you know, in these meetings or out in the public. So I want to just acknowledge and thank you for that. I'm going to continue to think about how do we help daylight the impacts that are coming or the potential impacts that are coming, because when those future stakeholders are impacted and maybe like you had mentioned before, have kind of like maybe a negative response, like, wait, it will be too late. The resources won't be there or the system is unstable in many places in the country. And so it's quite undertaking for us all to be thinking about the future impacted stakeholders. So thank you for that. I think that's an extraordinary amount of thoughts to hold in your mind as you do this work.
Oh, well, thank you. It's important.
So I want to end with the same question I ask all my guests. And it's particularly, I think, maybe a challenging question for you because of all that we've discussed today. I'm curious, Diane, what are you most optimistic about?
I love this question. For me, the thing that is important is that we have to start shifting to ask the questions about what are we optimistic about, because it helps to level set us on being energized for the future. Too often, we just ask ourselves, what are the challenges? What are the concerns? What are the problems? And we rarely stop to then say, but what are we optimistic about? So for me, I come from this perspective that we can do many hard things if we work together. And I am optimistic that we have really dedicated folks in the energy space that want to figure out the solutions to the problems and the challenges ahead, rather than continuing to be part of the problem or allowing the problems to continue to persist and sitting it out. So for me, I am optimistic that we will all kind of work together in a way that bring stakeholders together to collaborate, to help shape our clean energy future. And it's going to require multiple resources and out-of-the-box, cost-effective solutions to play a role in our overall better energy future. And I'm really loving being a part of this.
Diane, I share your optimism, and I want to thank you for your work. Thank you for your leadership. Thank you for leaning into the hard nuances of this work. And thank you for representing the stakeholders that aren't paying attention yet. So Diane Berman, thank you for joining me on the Energy Thinks podcast.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
That's our episode for today. Thanks so much to Diane Berman for joining me. There was a lot I found interesting in that conversation, but a couple things will change my work. One of them is this idea of how personal and emotional a stakeholder's relationship to energy is. And for many stakeholders, their relationship to climate is also very personal. And I'm going to be giving that some thought and thinking about how that can inform our work here on the podcast and our work with our clients. I'm curious what you found interesting, and I hope you'll reach out and let me know. If you are enjoying what you're hearing, please take a moment to rate and review us. If you'd like to know more about our work at Adamantine, check us out at energythinks.com. I'm so thankful to Lindsay Slaughter, who has made all things with this podcast possible. Until next time, I'm Tisha Schuler, wishing you and yours happiness, prosperity, and good health.